AM and 90.9 FM HD2 and HD3 Urbana.
Okie dokie. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Come to you live today, May 10th, 2009, here in WILL, AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Today we have a hot topic, an issue that is central to world politics today, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and related to that, India and Iran. Our guest today is going to be someone who's traveled to the region several times in the past year, who knows the languages and the cultures of the region as well as anyone I'm familiar with, and who has a grasp of the media coverage. Our guest will be David Barsamian of Alternative Radio, joining us live from Boulder, Colorado, to talk about what's happening there and what Americans ought to know and what they're not learning from the media. But first, let's go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
Many newspapers are bleeding money and sacking staff. Some have shut down. Others are shrinking their distribution areas or cutting out entire sections. A few papers have cut home delivery down to a few days a week. The Senate Commerce Committee examined the situation in a hearing this week on the future of journalism. Senator John Kerry of Massachusetts is the chair of the new subcommittee on communications, technology, and the Internet.
Newspapers have been a part of our daily lives since we were old enough to read. Today, it is fair to say that newspapers look like an endangered species.
The hearing started with testimony from Senator Ben Cardin of Maryland, who has introduced the Newspaper Revitalization Act. The bill would allow newspapers to operate as nonprofits. He says investigative journalism, the kind that is done by our local newspapers, is crucial to our democracy.
A 2003 study published by Law, Economics, and Organization found a direct relationship between the free circulation of a daily newspaper per person and corruption. The lower the circulation, the higher the corruption.
David Simon, a former Baltimore Sun reporter and creator of HBO's The Wire, said that high-end journalism is dying in America, and unless a new economic model is achieved, it will not come back. He says the problem started long before this economic crisis and long before internet businesses like Craigslist began siphoning advertising dollars.
The Baltimore Sun was eliminating its afternoon edition and trimming nearly 100 reporters and editors in an era when the paper was achieving 37% profits. In short, my industry butchered itself. And we did so at the behest of Wall Street and the same unfettered free market logic that has proven so disastrous for so many American industries.
Former Miami Herald publisher Alberto Ibarguen, now president of the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, emphasized that citizens are no longer passive consumers of information.
I'm not here to lament the past, that past which excluded many Americans, especially women and minorities, from the main pages of newspapers or the evening television broadcast. On the contrary, I welcome the democratization of media and its possibilities.
Arianna Huffington, co-founder of the Huffington Post, advocated experimenting with new media models and having smart policies that embrace the future by bridging the digital divide and keeping the Internet free of corporate gatekeepers.
It's a linked economy, it's search engines, it's online advertising, it's citizen journalism, and the foundation-supported investigative funds. That's where the future is, and if you can't find your way to that, then you just can't find your way.
Does it ever seem like the same songs are always playing on the radio, no matter what station you're on, what time you listen, or even what year it is? According to a new study released by the Future of Music Coalition, you aren't just hearing things. Future of Music's study, Same Old Song, examines playlist data from across the country to determine if recent policy efforts have made any impact on what songs are played on the radio, and whether independent artists have successfully gotten more airplay. In 2003, then-New York Attorney General Eliot Spitzer launched an investigation into payola, which is the practice of giving money or other inducements to station personnel in exchange for playing certain music. Then, in 2007, the FCC reached consent decrees with the nation's four largest radio station owners, Clear Channel, CBS Radio, Citadel, and Entercom. Part of the agreement, in addition to paying fines totaling $12.5 million, was to collectively air a total of 4,200 hours per year of local, regional, independent, and unsigned artists. Future of Music analyzed playlist data from 2005 through 2008. It found that commercial radio is still largely dominated by established hit songs. The data showed that more than 50% of spins were songs that were more than 5 years old, and that the FCC settlement did not increase access and airplay for independent artists. Casey Ray Hunter of the Future of Music Coalition.
So the takeaway is that this policy intervention really has had no impact at all on the space. And what we really wanted to do here is not necessarily say, okay, this indicates payola, but we want to put it in context with the sort of movement towards media consolidation in the last, 15 years or so, and that with these big, huge stations able to just gobble up the broadcasting landscape, the playlists have gotten very, very restrictive, and there's been a loss of autonomy in programming choices at the regional and local level. So for us, it's a way to point to also the need for localism in our broadcast media. Artists traditionally have been able to use this medium as one of the earliest rungs towards a sustainable career.
To read Same Old Song, visit futureofmusic.org.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Okie dokie. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We're coming to you live today, May 10th, 2009. The story in today's program is Afghanistan, Pakistan, the U.S. wars there, the threat to the world, what's going on. And how's the press coverage doing of that? What's the differences between the Obama administration's policies and the Bush administration policies? And what do Americans not really understand about that region that we ought to know since we're so heavily involved there? For our guest, we have someone who has been on the program before, a dear friend of the program, David Barsamian, the host and producer of Alternative Radio, the program which can be heard right here on WILL every Saturday night at 9 p.m. It can be heard over on the sister community station WEFT, Mondays at 6 p.m., Saturdays at 6 a.m. He's also the author of numerous books, including Targeting Iran, which we had him on to talk about last year. David Barsamian is based in Boulder, Colorado. David, welcome to Media Matters.
Thank you, Bob. Always a pleasure to be on your program.
Well, you know, one of my favorite stories about you, and I think I've told it on the air before, but I'm not sure, was when you and I had dinner about a dozen years ago in New York, and there were two other people at the table with us, and you started talking to the person who was bussing the tables at a nearby table, and you spoke in a language I didn't recognize, but I gathered it was South Asian. And it was sort of a halting conversation for about 10 minutes, and then you got very excited, and the conversation picked up steam. And you came back to the table. I said, David Barsamian, what was that all about? And you said, well, we started talking in Urdu, but then I realized his first language was Bengali, so we switched over, and I know that a lot better. And what struck me is you're self-taught in these languages, and you've spent a lot of time in South Asia. So you've been going back there through the years, and you've lived there at times, and recently you've spent a lot of time in both Afghanistan and Pakistan. So you seem like the ideal person to report to us on what's happening there to some extent, and also to help us decode the press coverage in the U.S. news media about what's happening there, since it's becoming such a central part of world politics today. And when was your last trip there, David?
Well, I was in Pakistan in November and December. It was my third visit in the last year. So I've been spending a lot of time in Pakistan, as well as India, and I was in Iran and, the surrounding region. I haven't been to Afghanistan in quite some time, but I'm fairly familiar with the terrain, the topography, and the political situation inside the country. But I think, to echo the words of Malcolm X, the chickens are coming home to roost for the United States in Pakistan and Afghanistan as well. A long series of alliances of convenience with warlords and corrupt politicians, double-dealing intelligence agencies, and military dictators have led to disastrous outcomes. I mean, Pakistan is a prime example of this tendency. It's more than a tendency, of this absolute element in U.S. foreign policy of aligning with the military sector of a particular country rather than the civilian sector. And this is essentially the South American model, where the U.S. for more than a century would align itself with the military apparatus and intelligence apparatuses in those particular states. The same thing in Pakistan, starting with the first military dictator, Ayub Khan, in 1958, followed by Yahya Khan, then the infamous Zia-ul-Haq, then most recently from 99 to 2008, Pervez Musharraf. Now the U.S., you know, finds that Benazir Bhutto's widower, Asif Ali Zardari, who's been in Washington this week, is running the country. This particular visit was really a kind of classic neo-colonial theater in a way. Here you had the smiling emperor calling in the vassals to the imperial court, in this case Zardari of Pakistan and Hamid Karzai of Afghanistan, and to be briefed and to be lectured to. You mentioned the media coverage. It's very instructive. It's a combination of acute arrogance combined with monumental ignorance. And the theme of a lot of the coverage is, can we trust the Pakistanis? Is the army up for the job? Is Karzai a reliable partner? Notice these questions are never asked of the United States. You know, the media never says, well, can we trust the CIA to give us proper information? Can we rely on the army, not to invade Pakistan? So it's a classic kind of headmaster with his swagger stick going around and rapping the insouciant students, over the knuckles. In this case, two allies, so-called, of the United States. It's a very serious situation in Pakistan and Afghanistan. And if I can just talk a little bit about the Pashtun people, I think that would be important for your listeners to know about. In the colonial literature, if you go back to Kipling as well, they are referred to as Pathans, P-A-T-H-A-N. But the correct terminology, and the one they use, is Pashtun. Now, the Pashtun population is about 45% of the total population of Afghanistan. So Afghanistan has about 30 million people, so somewhere around 12 to 13 million Pashtuns in Afghanistan. Across the border in Pakistan, they're a much smaller percentage, 15% of the total population. But the base population of Pakistan is close to 200 million. So there are numerically many more Pashtuns living in Pakistan. They speak the same language, Pashto, and they are linked together by centuries of tradition and culture. And in 1893, the British drew a line dividing the Pashtun peoples. That's called the Durand Line, D-U-R-A-N-D, named after the Imperial British cartographer Mortimer Durand. And this particular line had two purposes. One was to create a buffer between the British Indian Empire, at that time Pakistan did not exist, and Tsarist Russia. But the other thing, politically, what it did was to punish the Pashtun people for their resistance to British power. You might recall that in the late 1830s, the British invaded Afghanistan with very little success. In fact, there was a major wipeout of an entire British division. And then about four decades later, they invaded again. And so the Pashtuns have always been resistant to outside pressures. Now, they are constantly referred to in the media as tribals. I don't think this is a very good description of actually a people that constitute a nation. 40, 50 million people is not a tribe. That is a nation. And the Pashtuns have never accepted the British-drawn Durand Line of 1893. And why is this all important? The Taliban in Afghanistan, particularly, was entirely a Pashtun formation. They had adopted Wahhabi Islam, which is a Saudi-inspired, extremely rigid and intolerant form of Islam. This all connects to the American support for the Mujahideen in Afghanistan in the 1980s. That's why I mentioned chickens coming home to roost. It was this time that the U.S., in order to oust the Soviets from Afghanistan, recruited, using Pakistan, basically, as Tariq Ali likes to say, as a condom, using Pakistan as a condom to funnel in billions of dollars in aid, weapons, material, to create a fighting force, the Mujahideen, whom Reagan referred to, as you might recall, as freedom fighters, to oust the Soviets. So it's a very complex situation on both sides of the border. But right at the border, these two countries are joined at the hip. It's a 1,500-mile frontier. That's 2,400 kilometers. Very rocky terrain. Pakistan and Afghanistan are constantly being lectured by the U.S. and the media, the political class, as well as the punditocracy, about not monitoring their borders, not controlning their borders, their porous borders. Well, you know, these are two, first of all, extremely impoverished and immiserated countries. And number two, does anyone think about the U.S. border with Mexico, where there's, you know, a flood of arms going south, drugs going north? The U.S. can't control a relatively flat really, there's no mountainous terrain there between Mexico and the United States. So you have, you know, the Taliban was a direct outgrowth of the Mujahideen movement in Afghanistan, created in the 1980s. You have to distinguish the Taliban from Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda in Pakistan and Afghanistan are, I would say, almost entirely non-Afghan, non-Pakistani. By that, I mean to say they are Arabs, they're from Yemen, they're from Syria, they're from Saudi Arabia, they're from Algeria.
David, let me stop you 1 second on that point, because I think you've touched on something that's confusing to a lot of Americans, and it's not always cleared up in the news media, which is the Muslim world that we're talking about is not the Arab world. The Arab world is a distinct part of the Middle East that does not touch Afghanistan.
Indeed.
Or Pakistan.
In fact, both Pakistan and Afghanistan are non-Arab countries. They do not speak an Arabic-related language. I think what confuses people is that they share the same script, but they in fact, speak Indo-European languages.
Our guest today is David Barsamian, the host of Alternative Radio, which can be heard right here in WILL every Saturday night at 9 p.m. And also you can find out about Alternative Radio at alternativeradio.org. It's broadcast worldwide on numerous public and community radio stations. David Barsamian is an expert on the region we're talking about, Pakistan, Afghanistan, India, and Iran. He's visited there many times, speaks the languages, knows the history. If you'd like to call in with a question or comment for David Barsamian, the telephone number here at WILL is 333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. And David, before we get back to that specific story, one of the things that I've learned from doing this program and from talking to my students is how ignorant most Americans are, even well-educated Americans are, about this particular region, which is particularly striking in view of the fact that we now have, I believe, 60,000 troops in Afghanistan. And we're talking about Pakistan like it might be the center of nuclear war, if anywhere in the world is going to be, in the visible future. Can you just talk a little bit, before we went further, about the history of these countries, some of the basics that people might not know that that really would help put things in a little bit of better context? You've already done that now to some extent, obviously, with the Taliban and the Pashtun and the peoples who occupy the common area of the two countries. But, like, for example, Pakistan, what is its history?
Okay, Pakistan, land of the pure. Pak in Urdu and Farsi means pure, and stan means country. It was created as a result of demands from Indian Muslims for a separate homeland. The Indian Muslims constituted a very large minority in British India. And in 1947, Mountbatten, who was the last viceroy appointed by London to oversee the partition of India, acceded to the demands of Pakistan's founder, Muhammad Ali Jinnah, and created a very improbable state. By that I mean to say that one part of Pakistan was East Bengal, over 1,000 miles away from West Pakistan. This was to lead to civil war and the eventual break-off of East Bengal from Pakistan in 1971 and the creation of Bangladesh. And so there were many refugees went, many Muslims went from the new boundaries of India into the newly formed state of Pakistan. This was one of the great catastrophes of the 20th century and continues to have ramifications in the geopolitical situation and the unsettled issue of Kashmir, which has been, a thorn in the side of both countries. Now, Pakistan is multilingual. Urdu is the national language, but there are many constituent communities within Pakistan. So you have to see these, you know, Afghanistan, Pakistan, these are like little Europes. You know, you go 50 miles or 500 miles, you're eating different food. You're looking at different people. The same thing obtains in Pakistan and Afghanistan. In Pakistan, you have the richest and the wealthiest province in Pakistan is Punjab. That's in the north. To the south of Punjab is Sindh province with the major port and commercial center of Karachi. To the west is Balochistan, which is has good amounts of natural gas. It has a border with Afghanistan as well as Iran. So you see here now the geopolitical situation. And then in the northwest quadrant of Pakistan, you have what is called the Northwest Frontier Province. They even kept the British colonial name. And with adjoining that province is FATA. Again, another colonial name which the Pakistanis have retained. That is the federally administered tribal areas. This is the so-called Pashtun majority areas. So people in Pakistan speak Urdu is the national language, but they speak Sindhi, Baluch, Pashto, and Punjabi. Across now in Afghanistan too is multilingual. It is almost entirely Muslim. Pakistan is about 95% Muslim. There are a few million Hindus and small numbers of Christians, but again, heavily Muslim. And in Afghanistan, you have Tajiks who compose about 25% of the population. They're in the northeast part of the country primarily, but they're also in Herat. Ahmad Shah Massoud, who was assassinated a couple of days just before the 9/11 attacks by Al-Qaeda, he was a Tajik leader, and he's like their great hero. Then there are Uzbeks. There are the Pashtuns that I mentioned, the largest group in Afghanistan. They're the Hazaras in the central part of the country. They speak a Persian-related language known as Dari. People who saw the Kite Runner film or read the book by Khalid Husseini will recall that the young boy Hassan, who is victimized by the villain in the book, who happens to be Pashtun, the young boy is Hazara. And so here you had that kind of conflict between the dominant Pashtun group, victimizing the Hazara minority. So just to wrap this up very quickly, because it can get overly detailed, is that these are multilingual, multi-ethnic groups over in both countries, but Islam is the main religion, and Pakistan has a fairly large Shia minority, and there are tensions between the majority Sunnis and the minority Shia in Pakistan.
Our guest today, David Barsamian. You're listening to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580. David Barsamian, of course, runs Alternative Radio, which can be heard right here on WILL every Saturday night at 9 p.m. It can be heard on the community station here in town, WEFT, Mondays at 6 p.m., Saturday mornings at 7 a.m. Go to alternativeradio.org to learn about the work of that great program. And if you want to call in again, 333-9455 is the number here at WILL, or 1-800-222-9455. We're talking anything about media and politics. It's fair game with Mr. Barsamian, but especially what's going on in Afghanistan, Pakistan, India, Iran, and the threat of war in the U.S. role. Let's now go to the phone lines to our first caller. Line 1, Champaign County, you're on the air.
Hi, good afternoon. Always great to talk to you. I'm trying to find out when it's on the micro radio in town for the people that live close in the Champaign-Urbana, because I think it's also presented there at some point. So there's three different stations here that are running it. Always appreciate your work. You mentioned the way that's covered, the AFPAC is covered here, as it's called. I was watching Meet the Press this morning, and they had both Zardawi and Karzai on, and the punditocracy, Alan Greenspan's wife, Andrea Mitchell, is that right?
Andrea Mitchell is his wife, right?
Yeah, called them both delusional, and it seemed like it was the stove calling the pot black or something to me, because of all the misconceptions. And I will ask you, Chomsky had access to a poll in Afghanistan, and they asked who were the favored political figures, and Najibullah, out of the past, the last leader during the communist mixed reign, was actually one of the highest featured. So a bit of a surprise to a lot of folks that we're always told that religion is so very important, et cetera, and it is a factor, but when people are hearkening back to Najibullah's day, one knows that something is up that isn't often commented on.
Mm-hmm.
In Pakistan, I wanted you to comment about the lawyers' movement, because they got such short shrift here. For people to demonstrate against the superpower's dictator with all of his abuses, one wonders why people are so worried that, a small sector of the society, the Taliban, are going to be able to take over Pakistan. Makes you think that, other things are at stake that can't be mentioned. So I'd like for you to address those two points. And just as an afterthought, as far as religion goes, there's this bizarre story of the Pentagon burning these Pashto Bibles that strikes me as so strange, when we're always focusing on the religion of our client states and the designated offenders, and we don't often examine this role inside of the American military. So I realize that's a lot, and I appreciate anything you can, and I'll hang up and listen on the air.
Thanks. Well, thank you, caller. David?
Yeah, Najibullah was the Soviet-installed leader of Afghanistan, and when the Taliban captured Kabul, He had taken refuge in one of the embassies there. I forget. I think it was the Swiss embassy. Eventually, they got him out of there, and they hung him up in a public square and killed him. Now, about Hamid Karzai, he is deeply unpopular within his own country. The bombings and occupation, which is now in its eighth year, have not endeared him to the general Afghan population. He's often referred to as the mayor of Kabul. I think that's overstating the case, actually. There are some parts of Kabul that is unsafe for him to travel to. He was installed in December 2001, January 2002, at the Bonn Conference in Germany. After the U.S. had overthrown the Taliban regime in Kabul, they had to find someone, a figurehead, a new DM, you know, a new puppet to install there. And so Hamid Karzai was selected. Now, this selection was deeply resented by the other Afghan delegates who were there in Bonn. Now, why? He is, after all, an Afghan. He is from an elite family, and he is a Pashtun, a member of the largest group in Afghanistan. Well, a couple of things. One is that the people who did the fighting, who fought the Soviets and then fought the Taliban, felt that, you know, where was this guy when we needed him? He wasn't around. He was, in fact, a UNICAL consultant. He and Zalmay Khalilzad, another, you know, a neocon figure who became ambassador to Kabul and later to Baghdad and then Bush ambassador to the UN. They were both consultants to UNICAL, all under this project during the mid-1990s, during the Clinton period, to bring oil and natural gas from Central Asia through Afghanistan, out through the ports in Pakistan, and then out to the rest of South Asia and to China in particular and Japan. That never panned out. So there was enormous opposition to Karzai at this conference. And how was he installed? Iran was responsible for seating him in the throne in Kabul. They twisted the arms of the warlords who were allied with Iran. You might be interested to know about half the population of Afghanistan speaks an Iranian-related language called Dari. It's almost like Farsi with some, you know, slight differences. So there's a deep connection and a cultural historical connection between the two countries as well. So Karzai is seen as a kind of puppet, very unpopular. They have not been able to really provide the Afghan population with any kind of services. Now, the situation in Pakistan is quite similar. I'll talk about the lawyers' movement in just a second, but the level of economic inequality and injustice in Pakistan is particularly striking. You have here a country of almost 200 million people ruled by a small English-speaking elite, you know, who send their children to to get educated at Oxford and Harvard, and who shop in New York and Paris, who have very little to do with the rest of the country. They've basically been looting Pakistan since it came into being in 1947. You have an enormous amount of unemployment and underemployment. I'm not talking 8-9% like we have here in the United States. I'm talking 30-50% unemployment and underemployment. There is 25-30% inflation. There's not enough drinking water. There are acute shortages of drinking water, acute shortages of electricity. Yet Pakistan has nuclear weapons. It has F-16s. It has been given billions and billions of dollars by the U.S. to strengthen its military establishment, but nothing for the people of the country. And so this has created a real class divide in Pakistan. You basically have a feudal system that has been unchanged for centuries.
Unlike neighboring India, when India and Pakistan were formed in 1947, India broke up the large feudal landlord estates. In Pakistan, that never happened. And on these feudal estates in Pakistan, and I've seen this, is something called bonded labor, which is de facto slave labor, people who are literally indentured to the master of the land and can never remove themselves from debt. So you have this impoverished underclass that is extremely angry, is totally unrepresented, and the Taliban is now trying to, you know, exploit that particular economic, socioeconomic situation in Pakistan, where you have this enormous inequality. Now, the problem, and there is a problem with the lawyers' movement, and just very briefly, I'll describe the background.
Yeah, please do.
Pervez Musharraf, the military dictator, ousted a fairly popular Supreme Court justice named Mohammad Iftikhar Chaudhry. Why did Musharraf do that? Well, Chaudhry was looking into some deals that Musharraf had conducted and that were, you know, really shady and could be very embarrassing. And he was also asking questions about people being disappeared during the so-called war on terror. So many Pakistanis have literally been, you know, picked off the streets, taken to who knows where, and they've never been heard to again. He was looking into that. So Musharraf sacks him, puts in his own guy, and then the lawyers, who are, you know, really constitute this part of this English-speaking ruling class in Pakistan, you know, rose up and put a lot of pressure on the Musharraf regime. There were demonstrations, there were arrests, and this was very sustained over a period of time. But it was striking that how isolated the lawyers were in terms of class. There were only people from their community. A few students joined them, but there were no workers, there were certainly no peasants and no farmers, because that movement never connected with a broader mass of the Pakistani population. Then finally, when Musharraf was resigned under U.S. pressure in August of 2008, and then Zardari is selected, not elected, as president of the country. Benazir Bhutto was his wife, and so he kind of rode on that wave of sympathy for his assassinated widow. Then he, under pressure again in March of this year, reinstated the Chief Justice to his position. So it took almost 2 years of struggle to finally get him back into his position. Meanwhile, the war has expanded tremendously into Pakistan. There is a massive refugee crisis going on now in the Sawat and Bunair areas in northwest Pakistan. Hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people are being displaced. The military pressure that the Obama administration is exerting in the western part of Pakistan is forcing people out of those areas into the central parts of the country. This is again creating an enormous amount of instability. The drone attacks that are being carried out, many of them killing hapless civilians, you know, as so-called collateral damage, has created a huge wellspring of animosity and loathing toward the United States. The U.S. is extremely unpopular in Pakistan because the government of Zardari and the former government of Musharraf, they're seen as puppets of Washington who are doing Washington's bidding, they're carrying out a war against fellow Muslims. This is not our war, as one Pakistani, more than one Pakistani, has told me. It's a war that Washington wants to fight for its geopolitical interests, and they don't care anything about the Pakistani people in general. And I would say that is true of most imperial powers see subjects' populations as simply extras on a movie set. They're to be moved around, you know, as background scenery. You go over here, you go back there. When I ring the bell, you come forward, and that kind of thing.
Now, David, before we get to our callers who are waiting patiently, let me just follow up on that. in the U.S. news media, the presentation is oftentimes that the concern of the United States is to bring democracy and the rule of law to these nations and stability. I take it that's not what you're saying.
Not seeing it at all. People don't have food to eat. They're not being educated. Why have these Islamic seminaries come to such prominence? It's because public education has collapsed in Pakistan. It barely exists in Afghanistan. I mean, again, these are two extremely impoverished countries. And if parents have to choose between food and water and electricity and, you know, a halfway decent life, juxtaposed with freedom and democracy, whatever that might mean, I think it's pretty clear which way they're going to choose. And so many people have, you know, opted to send their children to these madrasas because they at least they'll be clothed, they'll be fed, they'll become literate, they'll have some, you know, opportunities.
Our guest, David Barsamian. You're listening to Media Matters. I am your host, Bob McChesney. Let's go back to the phone lines now. Line 2, Urbana, thank you for your patience. You're on the air with David Barsamian.
Always a pleasure, David, to talk to you. I want to thank the first caller, a good friend of mine, for bringing up the question of Najibullah, who I believe is actually a professor emeritus in Australia or something at the moment. But
Najibullah was assassinated.
Oh, okay, okay.
Yeah.
I stand corrected.
Yeah, yeah.
I heard that someplace. Okay. But they held out for months after the withdrawal. Why did Gorbachev suck into Brzezinski's trap if it wasn't for the real revolution that was happening? The untold story is the history of the People's Democratic Party of Afghanistan.
Right. This is. You want me to talk about that?
Oh, I would love to have you talk about that.
And David, please give a little background, because I had a feeling we're so deep in the weeds now, there might be three people on Earth who know what you're talking about.
Yeah. Okay, let me just go back to this. In 1979, Jimmy Carter's national security advisor was Brzezinski. He concocted a plan to give the Soviet Union its Vietnam by setting what he called the Afghan trap. Millions of dollars in U.S. aid, that is our money, went to Islamic fundamentalist groups in Afghanistan and in Pakistan to destabilize the Afghan government, and particularly to be active along the Afghan-Soviet border. Remember, at that time, the Soviet Union was in Central Asia and it had a long border with Afghanistan. Gorbachev had nothing to do with it at the time. He was not the prime minister of the Soviet Union. He doesn't come into the picture until several years later. There was a series of leaders of the Soviet Union. Andropov was one. In any case, they went for the bait, foolishly, thinking that if they don't quell the Islamic-driven rebellion in Afghanistan, it's going to spill over into Tajikistan, Kazakhstan, Chechnya, you know, all of these areas of the then Soviet Union that had large Muslim populations. So the Soviets go for the bait. They send in an invasion force of 100,000, by the way, and it never exceeded that amount throughout the eight-year war. They inflicted huge casualties on the Afghan population, over 1 million people killed. Basically, you had the same kind of situation now with the U.S. and then the Soviet Union, you know, with World War III weaponry against basically, guns and slingshots and a few mortars and RPGs. So when, the U.S. the other day drops a bomb in Farah province in Afghanistan, killing, nobody knows at this point, 20, 80, 100, 150. Again, they're just extras in the background. The U.S. is now blaming, the Taliban. This is reminiscent of the discourse around Palestine with Israeli propaganda. It's reminiscent of the discourse in Vietnam and Cambodia and Laos. It was always the Vietnamese. It was always there were Viet Cong, you know, hiding there. So, you know, unfortunately, civilians were killed. They were using human shields. This is another really interesting construction. You know, what are they supposed to do? Come out in the open and, you know, and wave at the F-16s and the helicopter gunships hovering over them and let's, you know, let's have a fight? Extraordinary. You know, I wish I could go back if there, you know, we had documentation of how the revolutionary Americans fought against the British in the 1770s and 1780s. I'm sure they hung out in people's homes. I'm sure they used human shields, you know, because of the severe imbalance in weaponry. So the Afghan trap was set. The Soviets, you know, go into Afghanistan. Reagan ratchets up the U.S. commitment to the Mujahideen in the 1980s tremendously. And, you know, it's often said that, you know, this led to the collapse of the Soviet Union. I think that's extremely inaccurate and overstated, and it gives much too much credit to the Americans and, you know, their so-called effort to liberate Afghanistan. I mean, the Soviet Union collapsed for internal reasons primarily. The Afghan situation was really... it was certainly extremely costly, but it was not in any way a decisive factor in the collapse of the Soviet Union. Now, I don't know if that touched on all his points.
Yeah, well, let me just do a little follow-up and bring it back to the present, if I can. If, for example, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton or President Obama were to call you up after the show today and say, we understand you've been in Afghanistan and Pakistan and know a lot about the region. We've heard from the people who listen to the Media Matters show. What do you think the United States policy should be in those two countries? What would you tell them?
Well, as a matter of fact, my cell phone is ringing, Bob. I think there's a 202 number. It looks like the White House line. But let it ring. I'll deal with them later.
Very good. You got your priorities in order.
Absolutely. Media matters first. Well, I think, you know, straight off, the U.S. should be reducing and lightening its footprint in the region. Why Obama is doubling the U.S. military commitment to Afghanistan is, I think, extremely not just to mention in terms of international law, a criminal, but is extremely dangerous and is going to lead to more war and to more death and destruction. You know, I mentioned that there are all these different groups in Afghanistan, you know, Uzbeks, Tajiks, Hazaras, and the Pashtuns and Baluch and others. One thing brings them together. You know, when they're left to their own devices, they fight among themselves, historically. But what brings them together is an outside invader, particularly when that outside invader happens to be mostly white and mostly Christian. This really, you know, generates a lot of hostility and resistance grows. So they have to understand that. And in Pakistan, basically the same situation obtains. I have been calling for, and others as well, for a regional conference that will bring in Russia, China, which has a border with Pakistan, India, Pakistan, Afghanistan, obviously, to discuss openly the border problems, the problems of sectarianism inside of Pakistan, for example, the inequities and injustices, economic injustices, which I've been referring to, which do not get discussed at all. And, you know, the Taliban and also the Taliban in Pakistan are now capitalizing on this politically in terms of recruiting more and more people. I think as long as the, you know, economic and political injustice continues in those two countries, there is going to be an enormous amount of turmoil. This will be a permanent occupation. George McGovern is talking about this as, you know, Obama's Vietnam, and Newsweek is saying, you know, Afghanistan is Obama's Vietnam. But he is making this his war more and more, and he is expanding it into Pakistan, and this could have catastrophic consequences. I think we really, you know, really need to think carefully about invasion, occupations, and the outcomes that they lead to, and the resistance that naturally these kinds of situations generate.
Well, David Barsamian, I remember in the presidential election, candidate Obama said made it sound like Afghanistan was the good war, Iraq was the bad war, and the key to it was capturing the terrorists, the al-Qaeda terrorists who were behind 9/11, and preventing them from doing any more of that stuff. Is that still part of the picture in this policy, or is that just rhetoric? I mean, what role
it's
does
part of the propaganda model that has been, you know, that has been imposed on this particular region, and the media repeats it without thinking. You know, I have it on pretty good account that, you know, Bin Laden and Zawahiri, the two top leaders of al-Qaeda, they're pretty much on the sidelines at this point. They are, you know, like Hall of Famers, you know, just basking in their glory of their September 11th attack. But they are operationally immobilized. And everyone I've spoken to in Pakistan who's in a position to know, and I think it's very credible, believe that they are now in one of the major Pakistani cities. They're not living in some cave. They obviously have a media operation. They're producing DVDs. They have internet access. They produce tapes for distribution. So they're in some major Pakistani cities. And I think at this point, they are marginal figures. They have now been emulated all across the world, in, you know, different cells have now, you know, evolved since al-Qaeda was formed, you know, taking al-Qaeda as a kind of benchmark, you know, here is what is possible. I think the Taliban is not an alien force. They are Afghans in Afghanistan. And the Taliban in Pakistan, they're Pakistanis. These are not people from the moon. They're not from Yemen. They're not from Saudi Arabia. They are local people. They have grievances, grievances over land, grievances on the whole issue of Islam. I'm not a big fan of Sharia, which is the very orthodox conservative Islamic law that the Taliban wants to impose. But, you know, that's culturally where they are. That's where they are religiously. And so we have to understand that and not, you know, be on some kind of throne and simply denounce them as, you know, backward tribals and, you know, illiterate peasants. So they have their own impulses. They have their own, you know, desires and their own objectives. And, we need to, you know, embrace that. It doesn't mean you're endorsing it, but we have to be more inclusive in terms of our political ideology. And, you know, and then to go back to your earlier point, you know, also about, you know, marking everything with freedom and democracy and liberation. Every single imperial power in the history of the world has always, you know, earmarked whatever aggressive action they were doing. They have been camouflaging it in this very lofty rhetoric. And they're always imbued with benign intentions when, it's not that at all. And that's basically for the home population here to, you know, as a smokescreen.
Our guest, David Barsamian. This is Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580. Let's go to our final caller, who's been waiting very patiently. We have two more callers. I take that back. Let's go now to line four, Chicago. You're on the air with David Barsamian.
Thank you. Being in a position to know, the author of the book, A Legacy of Ashes, pointed out that our country is Johnny Come Lately in terms of intelligence compared to ancient groups like China, Britain, and Russia, and others, and that our capacity for intelligence has been so sidelined and diminished as a result of the military dominance and organization and so forth. But you're addressing the comment that Secretary Baker made, Baker Hamilton report regarding our country has a policy that states we will go to war in order to maintain our access to oil. This is another figure in terms of the energy that is dominant in the world today. So given all these factors, I want to thank you for all the work you're doing, and as well as your presenting Noam Chomsky's work on East Timor and other things. And thank you very much, David. Bye-bye.
David, if I can just do a quick follow-up on that. Is oil a factor in Pakistan and Afghanistan? I understand that with Iraq, obviously, or Saudi Arabia. Is that the sort of issue that underlies all this?
It's in the background, but neither state has much in terms of oil reserves. Pakistan does have a significant amount of natural gas in Balochistan. But just north of Afghanistan, those former Soviet Central Asian republics do have large amounts of natural gas, and as well as some deposits of oil. So there is that geopolitical concern. But there is a tendency, I think, to overdetermine resources and to simply say this is the defining motivation. There's also, you know, what I call the mafia effect of, you know, the godfather not wanting any resistance and wanting to crush the possibility of any kind of independent formations.
Let's go back to the phone lines right now. Take our final caller. Again, it's been waiting patiently. Line one, Urbana, thank you for your patience. You're on the air with David Barsamian.
Hello.
Hello.
Hello. How you doing, sir?
Thanks.
Thank you, David, Mr. David, about your subject, and I think you've done a great job. You such a have a strength, and I think it's a great you talking about this topic. But I had a question. You covered a lot of things that my question has been covered, but I just wanted to touch on basic of, for example, the Malaysian leader. 5-6 years ago, mentioned that the Zionist has an influence on the American government and power to do things in the region and disrupt it, and he's been fired from his presidency. So I just want to talk about how the earlier caller talked about oil as an influence, but the fact is Zionist has an influence on Islam and destruction to Islam, and I don't know if you can touch on those subjects.
Thank you very much, caller. David, you've got about 2 minutes.
About Mahathir, M-A-H-A-T-H-I-R. He was the prime minister of Malaysia for a number of years, as a matter of fact. I met him when I was in Kuala Lumpur a couple of years ago. He's fairly popular among the Malaysian people. He made a comment saying that, I'm paraphrasing, that, you know, U.S. foreign policy is, you know, driven by the Israeli lobby, or the Israeli lobby has a very strong influence on U.S. foreign policy. Now, I want to correct the caller, because Mahathir was not fired. He served out his term, and there was no, you know, recrimination other than Washington, I think, making some very negative comments, and, of course, Tel Aviv as well. So Mahathir served out his term. He was not fired at all. Your question goes to, you know, is there a lobby in Washington that promotes issues that are favorable to Israel? Of course there is. There's an Armenian lobby. There's a Turkish lobby. You know, maybe there's an Urbana-Champaign lobby. The city is full of lobbies. The Israeli lobby is, I think, particularly influential. There's a good book called The Israeli Lobby by two academics, one from the University of Chicago, I believe, John Mersheimer and Stephen Walt. People can take a look at that. Norman Finkelstein has written about this particular issue as well. But I think if I could echo Chomsky and others, while Israel certainly has an influence on U.S. foreign policy, and particularly in the Middle East and Iran and other parts of the region, it is not the deciding and decisive factor. Washington will follow its agenda and its interests. And
David, on that note, I'm afraid I hear the band tuning up in the background.
Okay.
That means they want to clear us out of here. David Barsamian from Alternative Radio, thank you so much for joining us this hour.
Thanks, Bob.
I'm Bob McChesney. You've been listening to Media Matters. I want to thank Kyle Krohoff for working the board, Andrew Boyle for being my producer. Please join me in 167 hours, everyone, and have a great week.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance, private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events, lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
In the weather forecast for Champaign-Urbana, mostly sunny skies today and cooler with a high of 66 degrees. Tonight there's a slight chance of a rain shower, otherwise partly cloudy with a low of 45. And tomorrow, partly sunny skies with a high of 70 degrees. Monday night, partly cloudy with a low of 48. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL, 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD2 and HD3 Urbana.